Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Why have progressives experienced a four-decade decline in the United States? This is a question we have asked for years and will continue to ask. Today's guest, longtime labor organizer Jane McAlevey, blames a long-term shift away from deep organizing and toward shallow mobilizing. Again, she says it's because progressives have moved away from deep organizing and have instead embraced shallow mobilizing. She also believes that the split between labor and social movements has hampered what little organizing has been done. In order to win, Jane McAlevey argues that progressive movements need strong unions built from bottom-up organizing strategies that place the power for change in the hands of workers and ordinary people at the community level. Jane McAlevey is a postdoctoral fellow in the Labor and Work-Life Program at Harvard Law School, a longtime organizer in the environmental and labor movements. She's the author of Raising Expectations and Raising Hell, My Decade Fighting for the Labor Movement, and her most recent book is No Shortcuts, Organizing for Power. And Jane McAlevey, Dr. Jane McAlevey, now joins us in studio. Hi, Jane. Thanks for coming back.
Hi, Rose. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you. You're wearing your beautiful pink vest. You had your pink hat on earlier.
Meow.
You were at the marches in Oakland and San Francisco on Saturday. And I wanted to ask you about that first, because we did a show about how to keep the momentum going. And I am getting so many emails from listeners, from friends who are kind of political but not really political, saying, I want to do more and I feel isolated and I'm not sure what steps to take. So first off, 3.5 million is the low number. What did you make of the march on Saturday?
I thought the marches were incredible. And, you know, I have two things to say about them. One is we certainly are not winning by just having marches, okay? On the other hand, the numbers were the reason that Donald Trump sent Sean Spicer to run into the press room at 12 noon-ish on the East Coast on Saturday. The whole reason that they went in on Saturday afternoon with no plan, but it was a plan, to drop this debate going on and to start tweeting about whether or not the inauguration numbers or what they did, we beat Obama, that had nothing to do with the inauguration and Obama's debate. The entire point was to distract the entire country, which Trump is brilliant at. Let me say it again. The whole point was to distract the whole country from the real numbers that were hitting them all at that very moment. And the press ran with it like a bunch of dogs following a meat truck, right? Like, oh, let's go worry about did Obama or him. No, the issue is that 3 million plus women in this country alone, let alone the rest of the world, came out in record numbers and said, it's not going to happen, right? Now, the question is, how do we translate it? So, one, the marches really mattered. They mattered because the numbers were big enough that it mattered. And that is significant. We do way too many protests and marches in this country for the last 40 years, way too many, that don't matter at all because they're very small and hardly anyone comes. And the movement has come to believe that if you do a little demonstration and you tweet about it and then you Facebook about it to your Facebook and Twitter feed, that matters. And it doesn't matter. What does matter is 3 million in excess women who came out hanging from the rafters in teeny towns, little places, small communities all over this country. So it wasn't even just the coastal liberals, which they would like to dismiss, right? In fact, if you look at like Indianapolis, North Carolina, Alabama, like if you actually go deep in the numbers and look at all these small little towns and communities where women did something that they've never done, which was come out, that is the only number that really matters in some ways. Because, you know, Trump and Breitbart, meaning Breitbart News, meaning Steve Bannon, the right-wing architect who's now advising Donald Trump in the White House, who is sort of the misogynist racist-in-chief in some ways inside of the administration, they understand that, you know, the Democratic Party and liberals sort of have the two coasts locked up. So what matters is a contestation for the fight in the middle of this country. So if you look at the numbers, though, it's really a beautiful thing because it wasn't just coastal sort of liberal women. It was women all over America saying, uh-oh. We didn't really understand this was going to happen, and now we're not sure what to do. And that gets to your question, though, which is the now what are we supposed to do? But before we get to the what are we supposed to do, I just have to say I'm exhausted from listening to people say that Trump is stupid because he's brilliant. And the distraction power that he has literally every time he does something, it's actually for a purpose. It's to distract us. It's to make us look like far in the other direction of where he's actually making key decisions. Mm-hmm. And the faster that people start paying attention to the strategy of Bannon and Breitbart, Google them. Look them up. I don't even like Google. Go to an internet search program. Let me reframe that. And figure out what Breitbart and Bannon are doing, because it's brilliant and it's not stupid.
Can you please elaborate on that? Because I'm still waiting to read the long story about how Donald Trump took down the Bushes and the Clintons.
Yeah. So, you know, the most effective weapon that has always been the most effective weapon of the super right and of smart corporate right folks is division. It's turning people against each other. It's sowing fear, right? Fear itself. And then also just being sort of crazy, like how they took down, I think it was really easy to take down the people inside of their party. I mean, if you didn't care, he just did, he, meaning Trump. I don't want to call him. I don't want to honor him as being president. But Trump, you know, took them down systematically by being fearless in any kind of attack he was going to make on them. And at the root of it is that he was an outsider. This is what the Democrats did wrong. Trump was an outsider in a global moment when people are sick of the established parties. So there is, if you look to the Brexit vote, for sake of argument, which is when for absolute sure, I mean, I was already pretty sure that Trump was winning a year and a half ago. And I was in England during the Brexit vote. And it was incredibly clear to me on that day that Trump was going to be the next president of the United States, because the Democratic Party did not heed the global and domestic trend that people are tired of established parties right now, because the established parties have failed most of this country, right? So the Democratic Party has failed most working class people in America. And I want to say something I said a few weeks ago when I was here. It's very important also, I think. When I say working class, I'm not talking about white people. I'm talking about the working class. And the working class is black and brown and white. So in terms of the inside the Republican Party, people are just anti-establishment now because the establishment has been failing people for about 45 years. Real wages haven't risen in this country since the 1970s. Real wages have actually been falling since the 1970s. So people are tired of listening to mainstream candidates like Hillary Clinton or Jeb Bush. What the Republicans did was, the brilliance inside that party was, Bannon's people said, let's go for it. We're going to take them down because we understand it's an outsider moment throughout the Western world right now, throughout sort of the countries that have been, let's call us the former colonial ruling powers. We still kind of rule, but we rule more subtly, right? So, so they understood that, and they got behind a candidate who was going to just be a bull in a china shop, knock things over, smash stuff. He didn't care. He just wanted to win. And he did it. And what the Democratic Party didn't understand, and it was our kiss of death, was that we needed an outsider candidate. For people who say Bernie wasn't really tested, Bernie didn't really get tested, maybe he wouldn't have won, okay, that's fine. There's Elizabeth Warren, last I looked. There's like a huge long list of people inside the Democratic Party who maybe would have actually had a better shot. Who knows? But what the Democratic Party did horribly wrong, among many things, because it's not just about the candidates. It's about their policies for the last 40 years. My entire lifetime, the Democratic Party has been failing me as an ordinary person in this country. So, and now what people have to realize what he's doing now, though, is people have to really start to think very carefully about power and strategy and how it works, because that is what Breitbart and Steve Bannon are brilliant at. And part of why I think that the argument I'm trying to make in my new book is so important right now is because if you're engaged in really difficult unionization campaigns in the United States for the last 20 years or so, or 25, you have to confront really difficult issues that our movement has not had to confront or has chosen not to confront. If you're doing a union organizing drive, by which I mean organizing a facility, a large one, let's say, a hospital, where workers don't have a union. If you try, if you've been trying to do that for the last 25 years in America, my adult life, and again, probably most of our lives, right? But just going from my own experience, there isn't anything harder to do in the United States because the laws are so stacked against unionization, and the campaigns are run. The best campaigns are run by people just like Steve Bannon at Breitbart News. So the professional union busters, I wrote an article published in Alternate just after the election saying why I knew Trump was going to win. That's not the title, but it's worth looking at because I analyze a little bit what it is that union busters do. And those of us who have been actually coaching workers to stand up against vicious divide and conquer, use racism, use fear, use sexism, use misogyny, vicious union busting campaigns. If you understand how to defeat them, then you have a sense of what we have to do to defeat Trump. And it sure as heck doesn't look like what most of the movement's been doing.
So back to the Women's March just briefly, because we got so many phone calls and emails, they're still coming in, from people who feel isolated at home and want to stay involved but aren't sure exactly what to do besides signing petitions, calling your representative, what we hear over and over again from guests. And so what would you say? How do you keep that momentum of more than 3 million men and women and a lot of young people who want to get involved also? What would you say?
So the first thing I'm going to say is there's not a simple answer, right. And I mean this really seriously. Part of why the book is called No Shortcuts is because we have attention spans like a fruit fly. That's what Twitter and Facebook is doing to us. And we have to stop having the attention span of a fruit fly. The right wing, the Koch brothers, the corporate right has anything but a fruit fly sort of attention span. They have they're using Twitter strategically, unlike the rest of us who are like, blah, blah, blah. We just are out there blabbing about things, right? So the first thing is everyone has to sit down for a minute who came off that march, who's not been active before, take a really deep breath and think, how am I going to come to understand how to do power analysis and how to think about strategy? Like literally, the architecture of building an effective strategy means that you start by understanding power. These are two skill sets that have been almost blown out of the U.S. progressive movement. Because I'm arguing for 45 years, we've been doing tactical warfare and gimmicks that have deluded us into thinking that we've been making some progress. When if you really use measurements of structural power, we've been losing for about 45 years. So what everyone needs to do is, one, take a deep breath, and two, definitely stay involved. That's two. Three, the old adage of think globally, act locally is not a joke. It's really serious. So whenever I meet young people from Occupy Wall Street or any number of fill-in-the-blank, lovely, energetic, activist kind of oriented things, I say to them, I actually want to ask you a serious question about what it's going to really take to take down Wall Street. Because it's not just sitting in Zuccotti Park next to Wall Street, which I went to almost every day. I was in New York City then doing my PhD, right, where I was studying social movement theory. That's what I did it in real life, and now I've studied it, and now I'm going back to real life, right? Social movement theory. So I say to people, if you can't figure out how to do the following two things, you're not going to be able to take on Wall Street or challenge Trump. If you're involved in a union and you're a rank-and-file trade unionist and you have a union, if you can't figure out how to take over your local union branch with the best workers around, then you're not taking over Wall Street, one. And two, if you can't figure out how to run for a local school board or your local town commission, and you can't successfully figure out how to get your neighbors and coworkers behind you, stop talking about Wall Street. Just stop, because it's not helpful. We need structural power. And the two movements that I describe, the book No Shortcuts, my new book, is basically my PhD dissertation. Mm-hmm. So it feels different than my last book. It's not me just ripping off story, you know, ripping, like a rip curl. I mean, like telling stories. It's me analyzing. It's doing the same thing I did in my first book, but I'm analyzing the limitations of the model that we've been using for the last 45 years in this country, which I argue is the creation of something called a mobilizing model. So for people who just went to that march, they need to dig deep and start thinking, what the heck is she talking about when it comes to power and strategy? And it's really serious. And if we skip the step of understanding how to do power structure analysis, we then make bad strategy. So we've been doing that for about 45 years, and it's got to stop. So the first thing people have to do is check into what that means. Stop feeling isolated. Go down to your town council meeting. It's going to seem really boring compared to the Women's March. Let me just tell you something. Be prepared to be bored, because taking power is not about being excited every single day. It's about being serious and making a real plan and hooking up and start by taking over your neighborhood and then move to taking over your union, if you've got one. And if you don't, it's time to build one.
Jane McAlevey is author of the new book, No Shortcuts, Organizing for Power. Her last book, Raising Expectations and Raising Hell, My Decade Fighting for the Labor Movement. She was on, I don't know, 6 months ago or so talking about that one. But Jane is a postdoctoral fellow in the Labor and Work Life program at Harvard Law School. She studied social movement theory. She's a longtime organizer in the environmental and labor movements. If you have any questions or comments for Jane, we would love to hear from you. What are your thoughts about her? One of her main arguments is that there's been a shift away from deep organizing and a shift to embrace shallow mobilizing. And so many of you called yesterday, we couldn't get to all of you. So if you have questions for Jane about the best ways to organize, what is most effective, we'd love to hear from you. If you have any success stories, we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. You talk about the power structure and really learning how that works. And you write that progressives assume elites will always rule. At best, they debate how to replace a naughty elite with a better elite, one they can, quote, work with, who wants workers to have enough money to shop the CEOs out of each crisis they create and who will give them a raise that they will spend on consuming goods that they probably don't need. So talk about how you'd like that to change when progressives think about power structures.
Yeah. So
how do you come at it?
How do I come at it? So a few ways. One is there. It's amazing that the lack of even books available on this topic, and I think it's not an accident, by the way. But I have a method for doing power structure analysis that's quite specific, and it's far more complicated than I can do justice to on the radio program, and it's quite visual and graphic. So I would need like one of those Glenn Beck whiteboards or something, right? It's crazy whiteboard to work on. But I do describe it a little bit in the book, and in fact, the third book I'm working on this year is about power, because people keep saying to me, you keep talking about power, and we don't really understand how to do what you keep talking about. So if I do my work right this calendar year in 2017, it's very hard because the temptation is to just go right out and start running campaigns again, which I did all last year. But I'm trying to sit because many, many people have written to me and said, could you write up this sort of way that you think about how you do power analysis? So let me just start by saying when I was a young, very young organizer, I understood. I'm going to give this guy Solinsky credit for one thing, which was focusing me as a very young person on power and understanding power. And I went to a place called the Midwest Academy of Organizing when I was 17 or 18 to go to a 5-day intensive organizer training program to begin. What I realized then was only the very, very, very beginning of sort of trying to get more strategic, trying to learn how to actually win. I'm not interested in having a Twitter feed that has a lot of whatever you call them.
Followers.
Yeah, I really don't care. Mm. What I'm interested in is winning. And I've had the pleasure of most of my life of being involved almost in every single campaign I have ever run, just about we've won, including this last year when we were doing seven new hospitals in Philadelphia, meaning from the ground up. Like the whole time that the drama of Trump and the election was going on, I went back into the field, rolled my sleeves up, hung out with thousands of workers and figured out how they could actually change their lives. And what organizers do is teach people about power. So coming back to the power question. So we were literally teaching thousands of workers. They got a great class this summer in how to build power, and they won, by the way, right? So it starts by asking every single worker, who is it they know, and beginning to map their social networks at work. And the first thing we have to do is map what the relationships are among and between people in the workplace. And then part of what I brought to the model, and that model comes from someone named Anthony Thigpen, by the way. He's in California. He's someone I worked with from the time I was very, very young who thought about power in labor markets, which is how union organizers think about power. And I don't think about power just in a geographic sense because we're in capitalism. We live in a system called capitalism, and the economy is dominant, and we're about to see that right now. So I want to put a plug in for the idea that in a system where it's called democratic capitalism, if we're not, this gets to the root of the issue of why we have to rebuild unions, and liberals have to get over their bad attitude about the labor movement. Every day that they have a bad attitude about the labor movement, we've been losing. So we're in a system called democratic capitalism. And as long as we're in it, it means that our movement has to fight hard on two fronts. One is inside the workplace, that's the economic sector, and the other is the political arena. They're actually separate. the skill base for how we win in both is the same. That's what the deep organizing is that I argue and discuss in both of my books, really. And it's about what I'm discussing with you right now. It's about mapping social networks, and it's about seriously mapping them and then teaching people how to activate their own existing networks. And it is a dying art in this country, and it's a dying art because the very smart right wing, including the Koch brothers, Dick Cheney, and the whole modern face of sort of the extreme right wing, who's now, by the way, is in the White House and in the U.S. Senate and in the U.S. House in control and in 32 state houses across America, even more importantly, they understand how to do power analysis. They understand it really well. And they set out in the early 1970s to roll back the Voting Rights Act, to roll back trade unions, which were the two biggest developments to shift power in our country in the last 150 years. The development of strong trade unions and the Voting Rights Act and the changes that were brought about by the Civil Rights Movement, those were structural changes to how our society functioned. And we have to go back to understanding that structural power and power analysis is actually where it's at if we want to stand a chance to not have Trump get reelected in 2020 and roll back every single law in this country across the board.
Jane McAlevey is author of the new book, No Shortcuts, Organizing for Power. She's a postdoctoral fellow in the Labor and Work-Life Program at Harvard Law School. She studied social movement theory. And let's take a few calls before break. Let's go to Robert in Novato. Hi, Robert. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Hey, Jane. I appreciate the topic. I couldn't agree with you more. I consider myself certainly open-minded liberal. I agree that Donald Trump is a genius, and I'm frustrated by people who think that he's dumb. But Hillary Clinton is not a dumb person either. How is the Democratic Party or the liberals incapable of taking what you're saying and building a force behind this? The economic forces that you're talking about. I run a small business, started a small business. I mean, people are just very self-interested, trying to negotiate a company that has an enlightened self-interest in splitting up a large pie better than having all of the pie is kind of my thought. So I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Great. Okay, thanks, Robert. I would say a couple of things. One is, let me just start by saying that small business is not the problem, nor is small business for myself as a trade union organizer. I write a lot about, again, power and strategy. So small business is a place that, Robert, you should get going in, because actually most small businesses, if we sit down with them and we speak to their self-interest, a word that you've used already in your call-in, I think most small businesses could be a very strategic class against big corporations and the Koch brothers and the larger corporations that really are taking all the taxpayer money in this country for themselves and making it so that individuals and small businesses are struggling like crazy. So that's just one. We have to focus on corporations, large multinational capital. That's the focus of our work. All of my organizing work has been very focused strategically on large corporate actors and large institutions because that is where they are ripping off the ordinary people in this country blind. So, and then secondly, Hillary Clinton is definitely not a dummy. In fact, she's quite smart. Now, I may happen to disagree with her on almost every issue. Okay, not almost every issue, but on quite a few issues. But she's very, very smart. I think the challenge is this. We do need what Bernie Sanders calls a revolution. And we need to have a smart acting group of people who continue the work that Sanders began. And there is some out there. And I want to give a shout out to Zach Exley and Becky Bond, who were on the show. Right. In fact, when I listen to them, I think we say similar things, but in very different ways and in different arenas. I'm focused on building power in the economic arena. They're more focused on building power so far in the civic arena. And I think that, again, I say in the beginning of the book, and you read that quote, that the disjunction between the two is part of our problem. So I think just for Robert's focus, I think that we have to build not a Tea Party, but a Tea Party-like structure inside the Democratic Party. That's what Bernie was doing. It was a different approach than Nader's approach of running on the outside. We're in a two-party system. I hate it. Let me tell you something. I hate it, but we're in it. So what they were doing was very smart. And what a lot of left-wing and idealistic people just realized is how difficult it is to play politics inside the Democratic Party. And people better get smart to it. That's what I mean. It's patient. It takes time. It takes patience.
Well, so before we go to break, I wanted to ask you about this, because when Becky Bond was on, we had a few callers say, why do you think you can change the Democratic Party, a party that is so closely connected to Wall Street, Big Pharma, you name it. And our guest yesterday, Micah White, who was part of Occupy and said, don't let the Women's March become Occupy. You need to organize a third party like we're seeing in Europe. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, again, there's no question that I would like to be in a multi-party system. By the way, I mean, I come from Sweden, so I spent a lot of time in Europe, just in general. And I would say two things. One is the multi-party system ain't working real well right now in either Britain or France or Germany or any of the places where the far right is also rising. Okay, so it's not a panacea. The question of two parties versus multi-parties is complicated and interesting. But in and of itself, if we don't have the capacity as a progressive movement to build real organization and hold on to building that build it and sustain it, right? When I give lectures, it's about building high participation organizations. If we can't build high participation organizations, which is the backbone of sort of small d democracy, and then hold them in a structure that stays true to our values, it doesn't matter how many parties there are, we're toast. And that's what we're incapable of doing right now, because we've lost a skill set in this movement that we had in the 1930s, 40s, 50s, and 60s. And it was obliterated by design by a combination of McCarthyism, more recently the Koch brothers, and more, as they've gone after the only institutional power sources that we had, which used to be a strong black church and a trade union movement. They were structural power. And I talk a lot in the beginning of the book about what it means to build structural power. So to me, again, two parties, one party, three parties, I just want to win.
What about, and again, we're going to go to break in a minute, the women's movement, 3.5 million, and then the rallies that came out for Bernie Sanders up and down the state of California. I said this yesterday, but I grew up in California, and I wasn't aware of some of the towns where thousands and thousands of people came out. I had to find them on a map. Yeah. I mean, what happened to that movement? I know people are still active online,
yeah.
But what about, how do you take those two movements, yeah, millions of people, and keep the momentum going?
Yeah, it's our absolute and immediate challenge. And there's no question. And that's why I say so far, we are like, as a progressive movement, we are like butter knives against bazookas. We are completely out strategized by the corporate right now. And it's because we are deluded by thinking things like a big Twitter feed or a lot of Facebook clicks or a lot of somethings is doing something when it's not. So we have to, I'm so wedded as a strategist. I've been jokingly called a strategologist, not a sociologist, by the way. But like, I'm so wedded to strategy that I really think people have to stop thinking that everything they're going to do as a progressive activist is going to feel sexy and feel good. It's about taking control of your local Democratic Party. It's about running for office locally. It's about taking the school board. It's about taking the fire board if you're in California. There are people all over. It's really clear from the Bernie Sanders campaign and from the women's marches, again, in the small towns. There are people furious all over this country who have been left behind. And I'm going to sound like Trump, and it's terrifying. When he gets his narrative going about the people being left behind, there's a reason why he just won, right? So we have to understand as activists that the work is messy and it's hard and it's not always sexy and fun. Like going out to the march with my little pink hat on and yelling all the things I want to yell was super fun. And I do that about 2 days a year. And the other 360 something days a year, I'm figuring out how to work with my town council. I'm figuring out how to teach workers how to build unions in the local level. If we can't build it locally and then amalgamate it higher up with principles attached, and I talk about this in the new book, how did the unions of the 30s and 40s stay true to their values before McCarthyism destroyed them? It really matters. If you assume that we must be able to amalgamate our power, as individuals we have no power, as a collective we have power, we have to understand the mechanisms that keep large organizations democratic, small d democratic, because whether that's political parties or trade unions, there are ways that we can build big and build progressive. And too few people understand how we actually do that. So the Occupy types write off big, what they think of as big and oligarchic institutions. I got news for you. We ain't taking this country back from the Breitbarts and the Trumps unless we actually do understand how to build big, win, and hold on to our values in the governance of our organization. So book four is probably going to be about governance because because there are lessons to learn from the 30s, 40s, and 50s about governance. And yeah, I'll just stop there.
Jane McAlevey is a longtime labor organizer. Her latest book is called No Shortcuts, Organizing for Power. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we're joined by Jane McAlevey, a postdoctoral fellow in the Labor and Work-Life Program at Harvard Law School. She studied social movement theory. Her new book is No Shortcuts, Organizing for Power. She believes that progressives have moved away from deep organizing and embraced shallow mobilizing, and that is why progressives keep losing. Jane's last book is Raising Expectations and Raising Hell, My Decade Fighting for the Labor Movement. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. If you have any questions or comments about organizing under a Donald Trump, we'd love to hear from you. And let's go to Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you. I hope I can make sense out of this. I don't disagree with what I'm hearing, except that there's a couple of questions I have. One is, if you're going to try and move the Democratic Party in a more progressive direction, you're up against enormous obstacles, it seems to me, and one of them is economic. The Democrats are still tied to the economic system, and I don't think even Bernie Sanders went far enough in discussing that. So that seems to me to be a huge obstacle. The other thing is, if elections are all you're going to work on, and I live in a very affluent area in Palo Alto, and I'm probably one of a dying breed of people here who considers themselves progressive. If you're going to go for elections, and I don't disagree with you about that, I don't think, and I'm not hearing this from you, but you have to have something in place that's sustained, an organization that's going to keep on going, because I can guarantee you the right in this country is never going to give up. It doesn't matter how badly they get beaten, they're always going to come back, because that's their main interest, is making money. I think you mentioned this earlier. To me, an issue that doesn't get enough attention is the fact that we live in a capitalist society. That's what we're up against. And that influences every aspect of our lives, including this political situation. So I don't know how you mount. I know Nader suggested that in every congressional district, you try and set up an organization that's going to be ongoing and not just going to be a one issue, get somebody elected and go back home. So, I mean, it sounds like we're not on different pages here, but I just wonder how locally you can sustain that kind of an organization.
Thanks, okay. Greg.
Yeah, thanks, Greg. So I think that Greg and I agree. And here's a couple of thoughts I have about what the thoughts that Greg just shared. One is, part of why I'm focused on people readjusting themselves from, like, wow, the protest was cool and let's get arrested, to how do I become the precinct leader inside the party in my local neighborhood in my town, is because that is how to begin to build the building block. So when Greg mentioned at the end that Nader mentioned building a CD or congressional district level operation, too big Too big to start with. You need to just figure out how to run for local office. You need to figure out how to become a precinct leader. You need to figure out how to knock on the doors of your neighbors who you've never spoken to and actually understand how to have what we call a strategic organizing conversation with all of your neighbors, and then actually help people come to the realization that only by acting together with a real vision can they actually achieve something. So I think he's sort of right. One. Two, so the building block is much lower level than the congressional district. Like, the national players like Nader, they see the world as like Congress and the Senate, and that's a problem. In fact, the loss of the 32 state houses to the sort of corporate right in the last couple of decades, to me, was the most alarming, was so alarming. And our progressive movements, because of this cheap, shallow mobilizing model that we've adopted to for 40 years, are like obsessed about the national map as a congressional map. And the reason that the corporate right has been able to take control now of the federal government at every level is because they first took control of it at the local and state level. So what does that really mean? It means, as I said again, the hard work of trying to stop this country from being rolled back to like a plutocracy, which we're on the verge of, is about realizing it's hard work, it's local work. And the reason why I'm in favor, part of the reason why I think it's good for people to get involved in local political work is, one, you realize how unpleasant it can be. Don't do it alone. It's like affirmative action. You know, if you're a woman, don't go to an all-male place alone. If you're a person of color, don't go alone to a bunch of white people's things. Like, so if you want to get involved in your local government, which I'm imploring people to do right now, you come off the march, figure out how to take control of your local government and start building a bench that we're going to need for the next 10 to 15 to 20 to 30 years permanently. Like, we need to have what's called the backbench of people who are really good that we train locally who can then run for higher office. That's one. Two, unless we are involved in yes or, and I talk a little bit about this in the new book, but unless we're involved in yes or no contests, elections are yes or no contests, you win or you lose. Unless you are, and so are union contract fights and so are union elections, right? So my life has been, I have been in the world of yes and no, where when we lose, it is no ambiguity to it. We just lost, okay? We just lost the country, right? Trump won. So the reason I say get involved in local politics is the way that people learn the best, this is my social movement theory side of me and my Jane McLeavy lifetime organizer side of me, the way that ordinary people learn best is actually by doing the work, not by reading books. Even though I'm here talking about my latest one, it's by doing the work. Ordinary people learn by doing the work. So, and when you lose something versus win it, you can pretty quickly measure what are the things that you did that led to the defeat versus, hey, how'd we win? You can actually analyze how'd we win versus how we lose. As long as all we're doing is saying like, as long as all we're doing is telling people to like, go occupy Zuccotti Park and then declaring that we won the narrative change on capitalism.
1%.
Yeah, I don't care. I actually just don't care because we're losing the war, kids. We're really losing the war. So you do something measurable. If you just call a protest and a bunch of people come and you tweet it, it makes you feel good. But you have no idea if what you're doing is leading to actually winning strategies or being defeated. And I'm arguing that that's part of what's wrong. So in the union organizing world, for those of us who still do it, which is so very few of us, frankly, doing the kind of work that I'm talking about, like helping new workers form unions and running strikes and winning really great contract campaigns that are totally small-D democratic in every aspect of them. We have a set of obstacles that I lay out in the book, like they're challenges. Like, we have all these yes or no things that we have to do. If you can't win the vote just to start with, you can't even get to the contract table to have a union. And so, if we lose, it's really incredibly painful. And then it's called losing, right? So it forces us to be very, very, very sharp in our skill set. We must be very sharp, including, by the way, the skill set of how do you build a class movement that is intersectional, that word, intersectional, that means we tackle race and gender in every union campaign we're in if we're doing a serious fight because we have to, not because it's some identity politics like conversation we're having. It's like, if I want to win a 1,000-person election in a hospital, the boss has hired a union buster who behaves just like Donald Trump slash Bannon and Breitbart, and they're coming at us with buzzsaws and trying to divide everybody on who speaks what language, what ethnicity you are, and what gender you are. We we're not waking up in the morning like, what's the narrative message of the day for how we talk about Identity America? We're like, if we don't get Sally on the third shift who happens to be black and leads the black clique of all the black workers on the third shift, we ain't winning this election. So what's the approach to Sally, who happens to be an African-American woman? I'm making up Sally's name, but I'm looking at a worker in my mind from a campaign we ran this summer in Philadelphia, where we did actually just have to overcome race and gender and everything to win. Mm. So part of why people need to get off thinking that holding a demonstration and tweeting about it is cool is because they can't measure, are they actually winning?
Well, and also a lot of people at the march were angry because they felt like the class element was missing. They felt like it was majority white. Some people said they didn't feel included. What are your thoughts on that? And you argue that the race debate plays out very differently when it comes to union organizing.
Yeah, well, I mean, and this is part of what I just meant. It's really interesting. I think, I mean, first, let me just say, there's plenty of history of racism in America's unions. So let's just acknowledge that. Okay. And I don't mean dismiss it. I mean, acknowledge it. But I mean, for those of us who are still doing the work in a way where we're winning and we're in workforces that are a reflection of America, which is the working class, we do, in fact, we sort of see the question of challenging racial barriers and racism and gender issues and ethnicity and language, right? All, it's all mixed up in one. Because when you do a union campaign, you're not picking who you're dealing with, just like America, right? I didn't pick my neighbors, like we all just wound up in some place. So in a union organizing campaign, what's really different, and I talk a lot about this in the early chapters of my new book, of what I call self-selecting movement organizations versus structure-based movement organizations. I'm arguing the history of power in this country is about digging into structures, and this is what I mean. In a union campaign, who I have to contend with are who the employer hired. It isn't like people who have to come to the meeting or not come to the meeting are coming to the meeting because they think it's cool. Like, that isn't how you win over a workplace where there's a tough employer fight going on. You win it over because you start with, let's say, 1,000. I'm just going to use that number. It was a real number this summer, 1,022 in one of the hospitals, right? There are a bunch of big hospitals. You're looking at the map of every single worker, and most of the ones who we need to talk to win the campaign are not coming to our meetings. They are not coming to our meetings. I want to say this as a metaphor for the progressive movement in 2017 in America. Most of the people that we need to talk to win a hard fight are not showing up at our meetings. They have no interest in forming a union. They don't really care. They don't self-identify as a unionist. They're not left-wing. They're not in someone's Twitter feed that says something cool. They're ordinary people who come to work, and they want to do a good day's work, and they want to get compensated for it and not be treated like a jerk by their boss. So if you want to win that kind of union campaign, you got to make a plan to talk to 1,000 workers if it's a 1,000-worker facility. And the most important people you got to talk to are the ones who are not showing up at any meeting. So you actually have to make a strategy and a plan to go find them. And included in that, you have to have an analysis of, okay, so on the second shift and the third shift and the first shift, there's some white cliques, some black cliques, some Latina cliques, some Filipina cliques, some whatever cliques. Like, you have to look at, you have to deal with the complexities that are the American population, and you must overcome them or you will not win. Mm-hmm. So this is why I want people who are not engaging yet in the workplace, but everyone should be, by the way, right? Go engage in your neighborhood, because you're going to figure out, I mean, the problem is that we're a super racialized geography, right? That's some of the limitations of, Gary Delgado once said that's some of the limitations, good book about the limitations of the politics of Saul Alinsky, because they were neighborhood-based. Why I like workplace organizing is because workplace organizing mixes up ethnicity, gender, and races, most workplaces, not all. But so still, the reason why identity politics and class plays out so beautifully in union organizing is because it's simply what we have to do to win. And because we have hard deadlines that tell us we're going to win or we're going to lose. And we've either won or we've lost and we're out.
And we have an email from James who says, why has it been so hard to unionize Walmart?
Oh, my God. For a lot of serious reasons. More than I could even do in this call. But let me just say that Walmart, I would not be starting with Walmart, okay? You have to look at strategic workplaces. And in my book, I outline what I call strategic workplaces. In the 1930s and the 1940s in the United States of America, the CIO, the Congress of Industrial Organizations, that was the progressive and smart arm of the trade union movement that actually built sort of what we think of as the middle class. And included in that, I desperately mean a lot of black people who left the U.S. South and went to Detroit and the middle and Chicago and were in the steel factories and, right? So a black middle class, a white working class, all of it being created coming out of the Congress of Industrial Organizations, the CIO methods in 1930s and 40s. They did not the CIO in the 1930s did not say, let's go Walmart, let's go organize the Walmart of that moment. They said, we have to take steel and coal and auto. They thought about strategic industries. An approach to Walmart is not, let's go organize what they call the Walmart Associates. I'm sorry to say, I have a really big disagreement with a bunch of people about the strategy. If you wanted to go after Walmart, you would go after the supply chain. You would actually take the Walmart supply chain. That's a much more strategic. That's the truckers and the distribution centers and a bunch of people who they don't hire and fire in a nanosecond. Walmart Associates, that means the average person working in a Walmart, like a retail approach to retail organizing in that sector, is a losing strategy. And it has been a losing strategy. And the idea that people keep putting money into it is mind-blowing to me. It's like, if you wanted to take, this is what I mean about power and strategy. You have to do a power analysis. So right now, the thing to do is not to go think that we should take the retail workers in the front of the Walmart stores. The way into Walmart is a very serious supply chain organizing strategy, which has to do with ports, the ships coming in from China, the dock workers union, the trucking union, and the distribution and warehouse unions. It is not the retail workers who, in fact, deserve to have a union. Let me be super clear about something. Like, I mean, if anyone needs a union, you know, the Walmart workers need one. There's no question. But we can't just wake up in the morning and, like, have our favorite pet idea and think we can go do it. We actually have to think carefully about strategy. And that is why I'm imploring everyone who just went to that Women's March to figure out, what is she trying to say right now on this radio show, which I cannot do for you in 45 minutes. Yeah. But learning what it means to understand power and strategy is fundamental. And I'm arguing our movement has stopped seriously, seriously thinking about strategy and power for most of my entire lifetime. And it's criminal. And those of us who are thinking very carefully, what is the power analysis fight? What's the power analysis of the United States of America? What are the states that we need to be in? What are the strategic industries we need to be in? If we want to take Walmart, how do we take Walmart? It is not by the little mobilizing model. It's the mobilizing model that's been the sort of Walmart associate model. That is not the way to go after Walmart. There is a very serious, smart way to go after Walmart, and we've not been doing it because it's really, really hard, and it implies building really democratic unions and getting really messy. And part of why I loved when I was listening to Becky on your show a couple weeks ago, we actually used the same word, messy. Like, it's messy. It's hard. It's messy to do this work. It's not neat, and you can't just do what feels good to you. You actually have to do what's going to win.
We have time for one more caller. Let's go to Sarah in Emeryville. Hi, Sarah. Thank you for holding. Oh, did Sarah get tired of holding? Sorry about that. Jane, we have just a couple minutes left. You also say that it's so, so important to talk about the role that liberals have played in all of this, because a lot of liberals don't like unions. In fact, in many conversations I have with liberals or progressives about unions, they often talk about the corrupt union bosses, but not about the workers. And I mean, my dad was a union member, so I'm pretty, you know, I know the benefits of unions because I grew up around it. But a lot of people don't understand that. They just talk about the corruption that's involved in it. So what are your thoughts on that and how it's affected this movement?
Yeah, first of all, get over it. It's sort of why we're in the trouble that we're in right now. So I think this is a very serious topic, and it really so the conversations that you've had, I've had so many of my life. Because I work in the environmental movement, because I run political campaigns, and because I do trade union work in the trade union movement, I've crossed a bunch of what are otherwise sort of the silos of the progressive movement. Like, I've worked in community organizing, environmental organizing, philanthropy, even for a brief moment in my life, right? Like helping people give away strategically wealthier money, whatever. I've crossed a bunch of different sectors in the progressive movement. And it's when I'm in the environmental movement, or when I'm doing sort of, I just don't do it anymore, sort of traditional women's work, is where I hear all these comments like unions were important in the 1930s and 40s, but we don't need them anymore. You know, aren't they all just corrupt? Or, right? But there is this effect in the liberal elite that unions don't really matter. And I talk about in either chapter one or chapter two, I forget, but I talk about in the opening of the book, if you look at how liberals, the same people, talk about the civil rights movement, it's as if there wasn't a corruption in it ever, by the way, right? But when we talk about trade unions, all we do is parrot the mainstream media's message about unions, which is a corporate media. Our mainstream media is now a corporate media. And by the way, if you look at the appointment to the Federal Communications Commissions and what they're about to do to net neutrality, you're going to realize that they're so smart because they're about to take control of the net too. And then Breitbart News is going to be bigger, by the way, than the New York Times. Okay? So people need to check out Power and what they're really doing today, which is beginning to move to make it so that the net is no longer a neutral space. And so Breitbart and the fake news people can become the dominant news source when you go to click on your computer to search for any basic topic. But let me go back to this question. Liberals need to get over it when it comes to unions and realize that in democratic capitalism, that's what we call it. I'm not acknowledging that we live in that system, but that's what we call America, a democratic capitalist system. I think it's far more complicated than that, right? I mean, that's why corporations have way too much power right now. So it's part of why we have to, liberals have to seriously re-embrace unions, as messy as it feels some days, and understand that in a system where the free market, the myth of the free market at least, and the economic actors have so much disproportionate power, we have to seriously rebuild, again, a democratic bottom-up trade union movement, the kind that I write about in both of my books.
And we're seeing such a move to contracting and automation, and you know, so many workers are being pitted against each other. Uber drivers, for example, they're just trying so hard to get by. Bloomberg has a piece that they're actually sleeping in parking lots because they're so tired, and they've got to get up right in the morning to get that higher wage. And then they're being pitted against cab drivers.
Yeah, of course. So, you know, this is just it's a perfect example. I can't tell you how many people I know who use Uber, and I can't tell you how infuriating it is to me. Uber is a union-busting, worker-busting, working-class-busting SOB of a corporation, just like Whole Foods. And people need to do their homework and figure it out and put their politics in their pocket with them and shop with their politics and support unions.
Jane McAlevey's new book is No Shortcuts, Organizing for Power. Jane is a postdoctoral fellow in the Labor and Work-Life Program at Harvard Law School, where she studied social movement theory. Her last book is Raising Expectations and Raising Hell, My Decade Fighting for the Labor Movement. Jane, thank you for coming in. We'd love to have you back soon.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Call is produced here at KALW. Malihe Razazan produced today's show. Matt Martin is executive producer. Helena Murphy and Stephanie Purcell are our volunteers. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. You can email us, feedback@yourcallradio.org. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Thanks for joining us.